It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last evening, the Iowa Gold Star Military Museum hosted a commemoration ceremony in honor of the 70th anniversary of the signing of the unconditional surrender by Japan, which officially ended the Second World War. And this hour, we're hearing from World War II vets who were part of that commemoration. Joining me now, Jerry Yellen. During the Second World War, he was a captain in the Army Air Corps. He's a resident of Fairfield now, longtime resident of Fairfield, originally from Newark, New Jersey. Jerry Yellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let me start off by thanking you for your service to our country and thank you for being on this program to recount a few of your experiences. Tell us, as we remember the surrender of Japan, the end of the Second World War, do you remember that day?
Well, the end of the war for me came with the end of combat, which was August 14th, 1945. I was on that last mission and from Iwo Jima over Japan on a P-51. And my wingman, Phil Schlomberg from Brooklyn, New York, 19 years old, disappeared off of my wing over Japan somewhere or over the ocean. We don't know where. And he was the last man killed in combat. On a combat mission in World War II. So that was the day that the war ended for me. September 2nd was the formalities of war, which at 21 years old, I didn't know too much about. Mm-hmm. But I was thankful to be alive, to have done my job, to have produced a victory over the evil of the German people, not the German people, but the German Hitler and the Japanese people. So we did, 16 million of us did our job. It wasn't just one man.
Tell us about your missions. You were flying what type of aircraft?
We were flying fighter planes. I was flying a P-51 from Iwo Jima over Japan. That was one of the major regions that Iwo Jima was taken. And we lost 7,000, 6,800, 6,900, 7,000 Marines on that invasion were killed, and 21,000 were wounded. It was a very bitter battle. 28,000 people killed on 8 square miles of land so that we could escort B-29s, and the B-29s would have an emergency place to land. So first mission of escorting B-29s was on April 7th, 1945. I was on that mission. And subsequent missions. And then in June of 1945, the daylight bombing missions ended at the orders of General Curtis LeMay, who took over the 20th Air Force. Mm-hmm. And they went up night bombing, and we went up on strafing missions. I did a total of 19 missions, 7 hours and 50 minutes, 8 hours at a time in a little airplane.
Younger listeners will perhaps not remember the magnitude of our air force, the air power that forced Japan to submit here. You were in a P-51 escorting B-29 bombers there. How many aircraft are on a mission? What are you part of when you're up in that?
Well, the very first mission, there were many bombing missions that had 500, 600, 700 bombers, many. But on this particular mission, I think there were 120 or 130 B-29s. And 100 fighter planes from Iwo Jima escorting them. And the sky was full of flak and Japanese airplanes, and it was war mano to mano, one-on-one for the fighter planes. And the B-29s had 11 guys in them, so if there's 100 planes, you had 1,100 people putting themselves in danger. And they did it a lot. They did it every day, every 2 or 3 days. From what I've read and been told after the war, 60% of every major city other than Kyoto was wiped out by the bombing.
Tell us about your work. What is a mission that you remember most in your P-51 or another fighter here? Were there, for instance, could you count on dogfights with the Japanese every time you went up, or was that more rare than we might think?
No. Up until June or July, the Japanese were in the air. But then they had plans to repel an invasion, and they kept most of their airplanes on the ground. intelligence after the war found that they had 21,000 planes left, much more than was calculated by the American intelligence, and that they were going to use 200 to 300 kamikaze pilots an hour around the clock for a week at a time or more to repel the invasion that was being planned by the Americans. So people ask me about the atomic bomb a lot, including Japanese people, and I can tell you that it saved millions of lives, not only American lives, but Japanese lives. And the elderly people understand that. They have thanked many, many guys like me for having that bomb dropped, or they would not have lived through the war or after the war. They would have been killed. They died for their emperor in an invasion.
Tell us about the training that went into your work flying a fighter in World War II. How much training did you get? Did you have some flight training before you went in?
I've never been up in an airplane before I went in. I soloed after pre-flight on February 22nd, 1943, 1 week into my 19th year. My birthday's February 15th. And I graduated from flying school with 10 hours in a P-40 in August of 1943. So from February to August, 6 months, I had 10 hours in a fighter plane. And then I was sent overseas to get 50 more hours in a P-40 in Hawaii and join a squadron that was going to actively go into combat. But they kept five of us, including three guys from Iowa, Al Sharon, Bob Ruby. They split the Cedar Rapids, Cedar Falls, and Al Sharon from Waterloo were my classmates. They were three, and I was the fourth guy, and another guy from Hawaii, Jack Patterson, was kept. And then we got another guy from Sac City, Iowa, in the next group that stayed with us. So four of the 30 pilots were from Iowa. And I, of course, was from New Jersey. And to me, Iowa was a test that I took. It wasn't a state and it wasn't a place. It was just a test that I took when I was in school in New Jersey.
Uh-huh. So you had very little training, a few months of training before entering the theater of war there. Can you remember what you were thinking, what you were feeling before you saw actual combat?
Take a 19-year-old guy and put him in an Indy 500 race car, and you'll get some idea after coming out of a Ford pickup what that might feel like to anybody who did that. I went from a Stearman, a biplane with 250 horsepower engine, to a Vulti vibrator in basic training with 400 horsepower, to advanced training with 650 horsepower, to a 1,500 horsepower engine in a fighter plane. And it was a thrill of thrills to be able to maneuver and fly in formation and shoot at targets and do those things in training. And then we went into the Super Bowl. Every day we went into combat, it was like being in the Super Bowl. And we were the quarterbacks. We were the guys who had the maneuverability and the firepower to do the damage that had to be done to the enemy fighter planes or strafing on the ground. And it was a thrilling experience for me while I was doing it. It was a horrific experience when I came home after the war.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that in a minute. But first of all, compared to your Japanese counterparts in fighters, how was the match, the technology and the pilot power, the pilot skill there? How would you assess that?
Well, the Japanese went to war in 1937, so 8 years later, they had used up a lot of their older pilots, and they had a bunch of young pilots. And they had always had one or two older pilots off on the side of aerial combat, sort of directing them. And we always assigned somebody to go after those guys, those one or two planes that weren't in the combat zone exactly. So their airplane, the Zero, was an extraordinarily maneuverable airplane, but it was very light with a heavy engine. And over 300 miles an hour, the torque would not allow it to make a right turn. So we the Navy, I guess, in their fighting, maybe the Flying Tigers in their fighting in the early 40s, found out that if you tacked a zero over 300 miles an hour and broke to the right, they couldn't follow you. So it behooved us never, ever to get in a nose-high position when flying against the zero. They could turn rings inside of us. And so we did those kinds of maneuvers when we were dogfighting.
You mentioned it. Let me remind our listeners, Jerry Yellen is my guest in this part of the program. He was a captain in the Army Air Corps in World War II. We're remembering the surrender of Japan 70 years ago, official surrender of Japan. And we're talking with Iowans who served our country in the Second World War. Jerry Yellen, a fighter pilot in the Second World War, now living in Fairfield, originally from New Jersey. Jerry, you mentioned that coming home was a different story. You were not injured physically in combat, or were you?
No, I had no injuries, and nor did I ever think I was going to die. Nor did I ever think the guys, the 16 guys that I flew with who were killed, were dead. For me, everyone that was lost as they were lost would transfer to another place, and we'd meet again another day. You go into the military, you put a uniform on, you learn a skill, which is to kill other people. Some guys use a rifle, some guys a tank, some guys a bayonet or a cannon. My weapon was 650 caliber machine guns and a P-51 that I delivered to the enemy. And it was fine. But the reality of life is that we're not born to kill. And killing is a very difficult thing to undo once you've done it. So for 30 years, I had nightmares. I thought about suicide a lot. I couldn't hold a job. I got married in 1949. And it was hard on me, very, very hard. Hard on my family. I had no real dreams of a profession. And I struggled for 30 years. And
Before we get to your recovery, the remedy that you found, I want to have you talk about that. But tell us, what were the nightmares about in the worst of times? Were there questions, things that you might have done differently, for instance?
I never thought about myself doing anything differently. I survived. On April 12th, Fred White, one of my trained wingmen, was flying on the wing of Jim Tapp, and Tapp shot down his fifth Japanese Zero on that day, and White must have been flying in close to him, and he lost his coolant line, and he had to bail out. He bailed out over a submarine. The chute never opened. Al Sharon called in from Iowa on July 8, 1945. I'm hit, and I can't see. Dick Schroeppel was following me down eight ships. I was the lead, and they were shooting at me off of Chichijima, and they hit him, and he bailed out and got into a one-man life raft, and we dropped the big Dumbo, a 12-man life raft. He got in there, was hit by a mortar fire, and we had to sink that airplane, sink that boat with his body in it. And I can go on and on and on about 16 guys. Ed Greenwood got into a flat spin in a P-47, couldn't get out. So I talked to these guys. I wondered what it was like to die. I wondered what it was like to do the things to have. What were their last thoughts about? What was their last memory? What were they trying to do when they were killed? It's a horrific thing to have 16 guys, the youngest 19 and the oldest 26, die. You knew them well. Mm-hmm. I was willing to give my life, but I didn't. I was willing to do it. They were willing to give their lives, and they did. And when you put a uniform on, Ben, you learn that the people that you're with, their lives are more important than your life. And to me, my life was unimportant if their lives were in danger. So you learned all about you, all about the other people that you were with. You learned to love them. You were a unit. You were a Super Bowl unit. And they're gone, half of them. We have 32 guys in the squadron. 16 of them were killed in my squad that I knew. And it's a devastating thought
so
when you think about it.
It sounds like you were having to cope a lot with feeling guilty about having survived when so many young men closest to you died.
I never felt any guilt about being alive. I felt a guilt that I had killed people, and came to the conclusion that anyone who is willing to kill for what they believe, for expansion of their beliefs, is evil. And Hitler certainly was evil, and the Japanese government and what they did was evil. The people in ISIS today are evil, and killing is evil, but killing for your belief is the most evil thing that anybody can do. I've had a life, but a lot of guys that I knew didn't have a life.
Jerry Yellen is with us, sharing his memories of combat in World War II on this edition of River to River. Tell us, it certainly sounds, when you describe it so eloquently, that you were suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome, what we would call today. Where did you find relief? How did you learn to cope with the pressure, the weight, as you describe it, of those 16 young men, your friends, your colleagues in combat?
Well, a lot of guys that I knew came home, beat up their wives and their children. They drank a lot. They gambled. They took drugs. I played golf to kill. I played golf for an escape for 30 years. I couldn't keep a job. And then in 1975, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was on the Merv Griffin program, and my wife, Helene, saw that program and decided she was going to learn transcendental meditation. So in June or July of 1975, 30 years after the war, she learned, and in August of 1975, I learned transcendental meditation, and instantaneously had a perspective about life that that was entirely different than anything that I had ever dreamed of. The stress went away, and I became a thinking, feeling, I hope, a decent human being. Mm-hmm. And that holds true for today. We have 22 veterans every single day committing suicide from the stress. Multiply that out, it's more than 7,000 a year. 10 years, it's 70,000 people. 20 years, it's 140,000 people taking their lives from the stress of war. And transcendental meditation, if it only works in 10%, if it only relieves the stress in 10% or 15% or 20%, and I know it's more, it's worth trying.
Jerry Yellen, before we say goodbye, I wanted to have you, I see in my notes here, talk about this aspect in your life that, as you've been describing, through war, you killed, faced many Japanese, killed many Japanese, and later in life, you have welcomed, or at least have a connection with Japanese family in your life?
My youngest son, 1988, married the daughter of a kamikaze pilot in Japan. He went there in 1984 for 1 year to teach English, and now it's 31 years later. He hasn't come back yet. I have three Japanese grandchildren. The oldest is 25, and the next is 22, and granddaughter is 19. And I love them as much as I love my American grandchildren. They're human beings. They're good human beings, and they love me too. And so I found peace and healing through the activities of my children.
So you've been to Japan to visit your Japanese grandchildren?
Many, many times. The last time was in July of this year, August of this year.
How was that to take the first time you learned that your son was going to marry a Japanese, and not only a Japanese, but the daughter of a kamikaze pilot?
I didn't know he was the daughter in 1987 when he told me. In March of 1987, I saw the faces of the 16 guys flash through my mind, but it was his life. He was living in Japan, not mine. So I asked him a question. I said, what would her father say? What does her father say? And he said, her father won't meet me. And I sort of felt a little relief. 7 months later, the father did meet my son, and he asked him five questions. How old is your father? 63. Was he in the war? Yes. What did he do? He was a pilot. What did he fly? P-51s. Where? Over Japan. And that ended the meeting. He went home and told his wife, make the wedding, and she went crazy ballistic. She said, why? For 43 years, you've been telling me how much you hate them. You never fired a bullet at them. You didn't die for your emperor. Why do you want our daughter to marry this guy, Gene? And he said, any man who could fly a P-51 against the Japanese and live must be a brave man, and I want the blood of that man to flow through the veins of our grandchildren. So on March 5th, 1988, 2 days shy of 43 years of the day that I landed on Iwo Jima, I attended a ceremony in Japan. My son, dressed as a Japanese man, married Taro Yamakawa's daughter, and we became family.
Did you meet her father, the kamikaze pilot?
We met before the wedding and exchanged gifts. And after the wedding, we went to a ryokan and spent 3 hours in a hot tub with a translator, Mr. Osada, speaking about his participation or non-participation in the war. He was with 50 or 60 guys, and he and another guy were sent to China. The rest of his group were all killed themselves. And the guy that he was sent to China with was killed in a bombing raid by B-29s in China. And he was the only one who lived. And we spoke about cultural things and education and family and religion and all kinds of things back and forth. And when we were finished, he said in Japanese to Mr. Osada, the translator, that he never knew that there were other people in the world that felt exactly the same way about everything that was important in his life. That was told to me in English, and we bonded and we became family.
Jerry Yellen, that is an amazing story. That is an amazing story, a testament to how, I guess, war creates the other so you can fight the other. When you meet the other, it is a person that reflects a lot of the same things you have inside, I guess.
We're all the same, Ben. We're all human beings. We have to go beyond what we believe, because the sperm of any man can fertilize the egg of any woman. And we, as human beings, are just part of the rivets that hold the ecology together, no different in nature than the ants and the bees and the birds and the fish and the animals. We are the rivets, and we're destroying our airplane called Planet Earth by the things that we're doing. We're not in charge. Nature's in charge.
Jerry Yellen, thank you so much. The honor of talking with you. I'm counting my blessings just getting to know you in this way. Thank you again for your service to this country and for this conversation.
You're very welcome, Ben. I appreciate being on your program.
Coming up in just a moment, we switch from the Pacific Theater in the Second World War as we mark the end of the Second World War, the 70th anniversary. We'll go from the air to the ground and talk to Wayne Brown. Wayne Brown was an infantryman in the Army's 4th Division. He's a Marshalltown native. We'll talk with him about his experience landing just 6 days after D-Day on Utah Beach in France. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last evening, the Iowa Gold Star Military Museum hosted a commemoration ceremony in honor of the 70th anniversary of the signing of the unconditional surrender by Japan. That officially ended the Second World War. This hour, we're hearing from World War II vets who were part of that commemoration. Joining me now, Wayne Brown. Wayne Brown, a Marshalltown native, was an infantryman in the Second World War. He was with the Army's 4th Division. Wayne Brown joins me now. Wayne, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, excellent. Thank you for your service to our country, and thank you for being on the program today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Take us back to your World War II experience, the start of it. Where were you, and how did you get into the war?
Well, we lived on a farm north of Marshalltown, and we were out shelling corn for the chickens, and Mother hollered out, "The Japanese just bombed Pearl Harbor." Well, my brother and I had no idea where Pearl Harbor was. We'd never heard of it. And so that was our first, when we first learned about a war, you know. I graduated in 1941 from Marshalltown High School, and then the war came in, December 7th happened, and then we declared war. And after that, I was deferred for almost 2 years because my folks run a dairy farm on about 3 miles north of Marshalltown. And there was 18 cows, no electricity, so they had to be milked by hand, and no running water. So, it was hard work. But so I was See, my dad worked for the telephone company, so he had to hire somebody to do the work. And he had a hired man, and then I was his helper. And so I was deferred for 2 years till my brother graduated in 43. When he graduated, the draft board says, "We want to see you two boys Monday morning." Well, we knew what they were going to say, mm-hmm. that they would keep, but one of us could be deferred, but not both of us.
How was it decided that you were the one to go to Europe?
I was the one that decided that. I said, "I'm the oldest, I should go."
And that settled it?
That settled it. Yep, that mm-hmm. settled it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in, and it was a strange thing. I was just looking through some stuff here. I found out there were 18 people that went down September 20th, 1943, to Camp Dodge to be for their physical.
Hmm.
And I passed with flying colors, but I had flat feet. And that's why I went in the infantry, I guess, because they figured, you know, his feet are flat, a little more walking ain't going to hurt him. I always think that's funny, but I don't know how funny it was. But anyway, I went to Camp Dodge September 20th, 43, with 18 other fights in Marshall County, and we all passed and went in different. I went to the Army, and there was about 8 or 10 of us went to the Army, a couple went to the Air Force, and a couple, 3 of the Marines, and a couple of the Navy. So I went to the Army, and then I had to go down October 21st when I was actually in active service and sent to Camp Roberts, California for mm-hmm. basic training.
So you had your training. When did you first enter the European Theater of War?
Well, it was in June 12th of 44.
Just after D-Day.
Yeah, 6 days after D-Day at Utah Beach, where the 4th Division landed on D-Day.
So 6 days after D-Day, what did Utah Beach look like?
Well, it was full of bomb craters and wrecked machine, you know, tanks, and stuff wasn't cleaned up yet, but there was no danger there on the beach. So then I was taken to a hole and stuck in a hole with a guy and said, "What am I in?" He said, "Well, you're an F Company of the 12th Regiment of the 4th Division." That's the first time I'd ever heard of the 4th Division. And that's how the war started for me.
So from Utah Beach, the beaches of France, the army was driving across France toward Germany through the hedgerows?
Well, we fought in the hedgerows, but we went to the right, and our division and 2 or 3 other divisions captured Cherbourg.
Cherbourg, that's a very famous city.
That was where a big naval base was and a big harbor, and that's what they wanted to capture. And so the 4th Division and the 28th, and I forget there was a couple, three divisions that did it. But I went to Cherbourg, and we captured Cherbourg, and then our company was designed, and our job was to protect Pasteur Hospital. You know, Louis Pasteur, you've heard of him.
Sure.
And the hospital was named Pasteur Hospital in Cherbourg. And we were supposed to guard the doors. There were 2 doors. We had 2 guys at each door. And to keep, because there were German prisoners and American people in there that were in the hospital. And they wanted the Germans to stay there, and they didn't want anybody else going in that weren't supposed to, so that was our job.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that would be a great job for the rest of the war. That lasted 4 days.
All right. So when you were moving, when you were on the move with the 4th Army Division, give us a sense of the type of combat. What was the combat like?
Well, it was in the hedgerows. You know what the hedgerows are?
Yes. These are tall hedges that...
Around fields.
Right, that even tanks had trouble getting through.
Yes, yes. And if you went over the hedgerow, out in the middle of the field, and the Germans were at the other side on the hedgerow waiting for you to get out there, and then they'd shoot at you.
Right.
You know, so you were sitting ducks, really, what you might say. And that's where I was wounded. In Normandy, I was carrying a BAR, which is a big, heavy, almost like a machine gun, only you carry it instead of setting it down. And I was shot through the shoulder, and the Germans picked out these people carrying, they called them BARs and Browning Automatics, and they pick out those people because they throw so much lead out, they want to get rid of them first.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. They got rid of me quick.
But
I was about halfway across.
Right. Luckily, only in the shoulder, though.
Yes. And the bullet went clean through, and it came out right by my neck. It went in on my shoulder, my left shoulder, and came out right by my neck. And then they sent me to the hospital in England, and I was in England hospital in London, near London, and I was sent to a rehab hospital at Coventry. And while I was at Coventry, the doctors kept coming, and they keep digging where the bullet came out. They'd just heal up and feel, they'd start digging. They wanted to heal from the inside out, not from over the outside, because then get infection. And so they came in, and they had to go to a specialist with them. He said, I'm going to run a brush over your arm. You turn your head, and you tell me when you can feel it. I said, what's this for? You know, and so you feel that, you feel it, you feel that, no. He said, you didn't feel nothing? I said, no. He said, I wasn't touching you. He thought I was saying I could feel something. He said, where that bullet went through your shoulder, how you can use that arm, we don't know.
How's your shoulder today?
That shoulder's better than the right one.
I want to remind our listeners, if you're just listening to us, Wayne Brown is my guest for this portion of the program. Wayne served our country as an infantryman in the Army's 4th Division, fighting in World War II, a native of Marshalltown. We're so glad that he is on our program today to recount with us World War II as we mark the 70th anniversary of the ending of that great war.
I was in the hospital in England, in Coventry, and when I recovered, they sent me back over to Europe and right back to the same company, F Company, and same place on September 4th, is when I got back in combat again.
So what year is this?
That was 44.
Okay, so I understand that later in 44, you were involved in the Battle of the Bulge, coming close to the end of the war. This is, to remind ourselves, this is a last-ditch effort by Hitler and the German forces launching a massive offensive to try to break the Allies there. What was your role there?
Well, I was still in the infantry, and we, before the Battle of the Bulge, have you ever heard of the Hürtgen Forest?
Yes.
I was in that battle, too. And that was, I thought that was worse than the Battle of Bulge.
Why was that worse?
Oh, it was just that the terrain was terrible. It was muddy and big tall trees, and the artillery had hit in the trees and splatter shrapnel all over. So you could dig a hole and be in a hole and get killed. But the shrapnel would come down on top of you.
Did you get wounded there?
No, not till November 30th. The war was, we was just getting out of Hürtgen Forest where we could see a little daylight. And I thought, boy, this will be good. Get out to sea where we can see something. Well, evidently they could see us too, because I got shot in the chest with a bullet.
Mm.
But it hit a tree first and went to my chest sideways. And I got a dent in my chest about a quarter of an inch deep and about 2 inches long where the bullet went in.
Were those your only two injuries,
no,
wounds?
No, I was wounded later by our own artillery. I hate to mention that because you hate to say your own artillery but wounded you, but they did. But it wasn't their fault. And when I went, was wounded on November 30th, I went back to Paris. They took out the bullet and put me in a tent hospital outside of Paris. And it was before Christmas, and the nurses was trying to decorate the. We helped them put up stringers and little bells and stuff, and we thought, boy, this has been great. Christmas in the hospital. Wow. Well, they come around the day before Christmas and said, see, the Battle of Bulge came the 16th of December, and they needed men bad. So they came to the hospital on the day before Christmas and said, would every man that can walk stand at the foot of your bed? Well, I could walk, and my stitches were still in and everything. And he came up and he said, what's wrong with you, soldier? And I said, well, bullet in the chest. I still got my stitches. He took a tool and took out the stitches and said, now you can go back to the front. Before Christmas. What a Christmas present, huh?
Well, how did you feel about that?
I didn't like it at all.
So You went back, the Battle of the Bulge, something like, I think, 6 weeks of battle. So you entered midway through that.
December, went back Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They put us in 40 and 8 and took us back up to Belgium and Luxembourg, and then I joined F Company again. Mm-hmm. And so then that was the Battle of the Bulge from there on out. See, the Bulge was from the 16th of December to the 25th of January. And, you know, if a lot of people say, well, the Bulge was this till the 25th, there was a lot of people killed after the 25th of January. A lot of them.
Right.
You know, but it wasn't considered Battle of the Bulge.
How often did you think that you would be in the number of those not coming back to the United States?
You thought about it all the time, you know, and each time you went back, it was worse. You know, I told the reporter when he interviewed me up here in Marshalltown, I said, I thought if they keep sending me back, sooner or later, my luck's going to run out. You know, you can have so many close calls and then something's going to happen. And so it was worse going back, and I can't imagine the people that go over there for three or four tours now. You know, they come home for 6 months or a year and then go back for another. I can't imagine that. I just, no wonder they're having trouble, you know.
Right. Wayne Brown is with us, if you just joined us, infantryman in the 4th Army Division during the Second World War, a Marshalltown native. Talk about when the war ended and you came back from Europe to Iowa. What was that like?
Well, I was in Bad Tölz, Germany, that's south of Munich, and the war ended May 8th, and then the 4th Division came home as a unit. I mean, each regiment came home on a boat. The 12th Regiment came on one boat. And we came home, we pulled into New York Harbor, and when them boys saw and I saw the Statue of Liberty, I tell you, some of them even cried. I didn't cry, but I felt like I could, because I never thought I'd ever see it, you know. And so I came right home then and got home in July 16th or something like that. 10 days later, I was married. And 2 weeks after that, my birthday was August 12th.
Mm-hmm.
So then we were on our way, kind of like a honeymoon, up to see my uncle in Minneapolis. We got into Albert Lea, Minnesota, and there was church bells going and sirens going off. And I said, is there a fire or something? And a guy along the street said, well, didn't you hear? Japan surrendered. Well, talk about a happy guy. I was very happy.
That meant otherwise you would have been going to the Pacific.
That was what our division was going to do. I think it was going to be the third wave to invade Japan.
So
and we didn't like that too well, but I guess that's what they planned. So that's where we'd have went. We went back to Camp Butner, North Carolina, and that's where we were supposed to go and be trained.
So just a few days after coming home from fighting in Europe, you got married. Was this a woman who you'd been in contact with all the time in Europe?
I'd only known her about 3 months when I went in. We weren't married or anything, and she wrote me almost every day. One page maybe, but every day.
How important was that?
Very important, but it was hard to get mail because when you get wounded, you go to the hospital, your letters go to where you were supposed to be, then it's forwarded to the hospital. By then you're in rehab, then they send it to that hospital, and you're back at the front. So by the time I got mail, a bundle of mail wrapped with rubber bands, it was 2 or 3 inches thick. Can you imagine that nowadays? I mean, nowadays you can talk to people and see them on, as you talk to them.
Right, the people from a war front, soldiers are Skyping with their family back
that's
in Iowa.
That's right, right. And here we went weeks and didn't even hear from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of bad, too. And the radio communications over there was nothing like they are now. I mean, your radio gets knocked out, and that's how I got wounded the third time. We was taking a town, and the somebody going in on another street said there was a tank firing on them. They're going to pull back and shell that intersection.
Right.
Well, our radio man had been hit, and the radio knocked out. We had no communications. We had 8 German prisoners going into the second house, and all at once our own artillery started shelling us. And well, I tell you, they poured shells in there. Now, I know how the Germans felt.
Right.
And it came through the roof of the house and exploded, and I still had the shrapnel that hit me in the back.
You were physically wounded at least three times,
yep,
there.
Three times.
When you came back, did you have any mental scars to deal with?
I didn't think I did. I mean, I'm sure my wife said that I talked in my sleep a lot and you know, restless and everything. And my sister just told me the other day, she said, that Dad told me about the neighbor blowing stumps, and that really shook you up. And I said, well, I kind of remember that. And she said, Dad told me, he said, boy, was Wayne shook up when they heard them blasts.
Mm-hmm. What was the thinking that allowed you to cope with all the killing that was around you and that you participated in?
Well, I don't know. We just, I'm from Iowa, and I've been through winters, and the Battle of Bulge winter was the worst in 40 years, but it wasn't so bad in Iowa. They weren't shooting at you. And I want to tell you the story. Bob Randall had his 90th birthday here in Marshalltown, and I went to his birthday party, and he was telling me he was talking to some fifth graders here in Marshalltown at the school.
Yep.
And guess what the first question, he said, now any question, guess what the first question they asked him? How many did you kill?
How many did you kill?
Yeah.
What do you say to that as a veteran?
Well, I'll tell you, I never knew I killed anybody, to tell you the truth. I sent a lot of lead out, but if everybody's shooting, how do you know who hit the guy? You know, if 20 people are shooting and one and he goes down, are you the one that hit him or did somebody else?
Did you have, early on in the war, any hesitancies towards killing the combatants?
Yes, I did, and I'll tell you one thing I saw. When I first saw the first German boy dead, laying along the road, his helmet was off, he's blonde-haired, nice-looking fellow, just like us, and I thought then, what are we doing? Killing each other? Why? I didn't hate him. I didn't shoot him, but then somebody did. And why are we shooting at each other and killing each other? But it was either shoot or be shot, you know, one or the other. So
right.
That's what you did.
So, Wayne, you must have thought about the question why you were meant to survive. Were you just lucky? How do you explain it?
No. I think there was something besides luck. Because there was too many close calls, not by the three wounds and bullet through the helmet, but there was other close calls, too. And you think... I told somebody I was lucky, and were you lucky? And I said, I don't think so. I think there was somebody looking over me that wanted something else from me.
You know what that was that they wanted? That this person looking over,
well,
this being looking
know.
Over you wanted?
We've been married for 70 years. Maybe that was something. And we have the three great children.
One more thing I wanted to ask you about your experience in World War II, if I could, before we said goodbye here, Wayne. I wonder if you still have any articles from that you carried with you in combat in Europe. Do you have anything around home that is an article?
I did collect some stuff, like the helmet with a bullet hole through it. Somebody said, how did you bring that home? How did they let you have that? And I said, well, they wanted me to replace it with a new one. I said, listen, if something goes in that hole and kills me, it was meant to be. So I've got it, and I've got the shrapnel that hit me in the back, and I have a few other things, and a little pamphlet Bible that we got that when I was overseas. I don't remember having it in the United States.
Wayne Brown. What a pleasure and honor to speak with you about your experiences during World War II and your reflections. Wayne Brown, a Marshalltown native, was in the infantry in the Army's 4th Division, landed on Utah Beach just 6 days after D-Day in June of 1944.
Yeah.
Wayne Brown, thanks so much for this conversation. You take care.
wonderful. Thank you for inviting me.
And that does it for this edition of River to River. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.